Did you know Spotify has podcasts? If you didn't, thanks to that rhetorical question, now you do. From true crime to music and comedy, there are thousands to choose from. Find all your favourites and exclusive Spotify originals. Get a new angle on the news with We Need to Talk About. Get your dose of pop culture on David's Out for a Good Time. Or keep up with the latest on street culture with Who We Be Talks with DJ Semtex and Paris O. Discover podcasts on Spotify.
Welcome to the Freedom Report.
What I love about Austin Peterson is his love of the battle. He wants to fight.
Austin was, of course, the rabble-rouser, just to make sure I stayed Rothbardian.
We live in a world fraught with danger, and there is a certain amount of danger that the public must endure in order to secure the blessings of liberty.
For economic freedom and personal liberty. Hello, my name is Austin Peterson, host of the Freedom Report podcast. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Today is Tuesday, December the 18th, and today's podcast is going to be something a little bit different, a special treat for all of you. Ho, ho, ho. Happy holidays. It's the Christmas season here in Kansas City, and I'm here with a couple of my friends to review a documentary film that had a limited screening here in the United States called They Shall Not Grow Old by Peter Jackson. Many of you know Peter Jackson through his filmography. His greatest works, obviously most well-known, Lord of the Rings. Peter Jackson directed a World War I documentary film using footage from the Imperial War Museum to basically bring to life some seen and unseen footage from World War I. And I am here with a couple of my friends here in Kansas City who came to see this documentary film, They Shall Not Grow Old, with me. And I'd like to introduce you to them now. Jack, welcome to the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jack Stocker. You may have heard of me from the previous episodes. I am currently here on vacation to celebrate my 21st birthday with Austin. And we went to go see the movie, and that was awesome. And I'm also a writer over at TLR, and you can find me there. I'm also a student in college at Northern Illinois University. But that's about me.
Jack and I got acquainted after we met at St. Louis's Young Americans for Liberty Conference last year, where I said he had a Richard Spencer haircut. And we've been friends ever since. I referred to him as a famous fascist, or, you know, a D-list fascist, Richard Spencer. But Jack and I have been buddies ever since. And if you do recognize his voice, it's possible you may have heard him on one of our Twitch live streams. Jack has been coming in and being a guest host on the the Freedom Report's sister stream, which is our Twitch live stream over at AP for Liberty. You can check us out there. And another friend of the Twitch live stream, and actually someone who I met during my U.S. Senate campaign here, a fellow Missourian, Camelia Bloster. Camelia, welcome to the Freedom Report podcast.
Thanks. Hi.
Yeah. So, Camelia, tell us, how did you get caught up with us tonight to see this documentary film? Just real brief.
I've been listening to podcasts about World War I for a while and kind of fell in love with it and found out this was coming, and Jack was coming to visit, so we wanted to come hang out with him and celebrate his birthday and go see the World War I documentary together.
Oh, and many of you know who are listening, we just celebrated the end of the end of World War I, the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I with the armistice. That was signed in November of 1918, and Kansas City, one mile from, maybe half a mile from where we're at right now, is the World War I Memorial, the Liberty Memorial. I live downtown very close to the Liberty Memorial, and there have been some celebrations and some remembrances of this conflict. And of course, if you've been, again, following our Twitch live streams, Jack and Camille and I have been playing and enjoying a game called Battlefield 1, which is a sort of first-person shooter video game rendition of World War I, and we've had some fun live streams. We've done some history live streams surrounding that, and we've been discussing about how World War I really, what lessons World War I has for us today. So we thought it would be perfect to discuss this documentary film that we just saw. And if you have not had a chance to see it and you're not a fan of spoilers, there will be spoilers in this podcast. So if you don't want to hear some of the wonderful and magical and exciting things that you will want to see for yourself, probably not a good idea for you to listen to this. Jack, did you want to?
We'll try and keep it spoiler-free during the first part of it. I doubt we'll be able to really tell when we get into the spoilers, as opposed to some reviews you might hear more formally online.
Yeah.
But one thing I will say, I think that we can all agree on, go see it. You can see it on the 27th of December. It's going to be in theaters. You can probably find one near you. go see this movie. I think that we can at least spoil that at the beginning.
Yeah, the good news for Peter Jackson and for the documentary filmmakers is that when my dad called, I bought him a special ticket. My dad called me tonight because he got to the theater first and said, it's all sold out, we can't get in. And I'm like, oh no, we had tickets because we planned a month in advance once we heard that the screenings were going to expand beyond the United Kingdom. Camellia helped organize and get this all together, and we had a wonderful time. My father enjoyed it, and there were some moments in the film that I think we gasped in shock. Yes. Because some of the footage I've seen before, some of the explosions, but we actually, it was a treat, we saw it in 3D. And we didn't even know that we were going to see it in 3D. But again, spoiler alert here, I'll say this. For me, and I'd like you guys to tell me what was your favorite moment, but the moment for me that really stood out was the sort of Judy Garland in Oz moment, the Wizard of Oz moment, when you're traveling, you spend the first part of the documentary where the soldiers are getting prepared for the war, and you're watching this in black and white, and you're seeing things that you're used to seeing, until finally you reach the front and we have a Wizard of Oz moment. And all of a sudden we go from the old footage and we're in the new footage that Peter Jackson has restored. And it was, I think I let out an audible gasp because it was just so stark to see these men who didn't seem real before. They didn't seem quite human. They seemed more robotic. But to see them in living color and to see them moving at a frame rate such as it was, I was shocked. So my favorite moment was the first reveal. What was your favorite moment, Camellia?
That was mine too, because I mean, you know, when you move from that, it just everything came to life, and it really was breathtaking, and the colors were done so well and they were so vivid that I mean, you could imagine yourself being there.
What about you, Jack?
I'm actually going to go a bit against the grain from these two. My favorite moment was much later in the film, during the end of the war, where they symbolize it. And here's a really beautiful part about the production. The sound, pretty much from the start of entering the war till that moment, had been near constant shell fire. And then it just stops all at once. The last shell falls and it lingers just a second long enough that you feel the impact of that end. And you feel the sort of silence that comes forth from that. And it really sets in that feeling of the end of the war. The sort of near shocked, if not just right out shocked, reality that sets in for all of these men who'd been fighting for 4 years at that point.
The money that I spent on these tickets was probably one of the best values I've ever spent on a theater ticket, simply because not only did you get to see the documentary film, but Peter Jackson was gracious enough to offer us another 30-minute documentary after the completion of the original to show us how he made it.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And this will be included in the 27th showing, if I recall correctly from what he said. It's going to be part of the exclusive showings, so if you want to catch that, go do that. But it's really great because it goes into the details of how they made this stuff, how they restored it, they colorized it, the amount of detail that went into it. I mean, you also get to see a good look at Peter Jackson's dedication to this. He had an entire wardrobe of World War I stuff. He had a whole collection that puts Austin's collection to shame.
Yeah, for the uniforms and the beautiful war memorabilia, he had all these magazines.
He had a cannon.
he had artillery, right? Yeah. He had his World War I laying around, as you do. But, you know, it was fun to watch them doing the Foley, you know, how they basically were making the sound effects, you know, the mud, the sloshing through the mud in order to give you that impression. The cinematography was one thing, but I think what was really exciting and terrifying was the revelations of the way that these men died, because it's kind of like with the Civil War in the United States, where, you know, 650,000 Americans died, but it was the vast majority of them that died from disease. One of the stories that what really struck out to me was the fact that if you stepped off of the wooden path that they had put through the mud and you sunk down, you were gone. I mean, you could be just outside of arm's reach and no one would be able to get to you. I mean, what an absolute horror to live in. I can't imagine the kind of fear that it would instill in you if you were one of the soldiers on the boards who saw someone you knew who was just too far out in the mud and you couldn't get them. It's like a Titanic scenario, like a disaster, a natural disaster, not just a man-made disaster in a way, right?
Yeah. One huge thing about it, too, is just kind of what really set in, what really hit me, is the reaction of these men to this stuff. Like, going into the war, they were excited. In the war, it just kind of became life because you know, I just turned 21. And these guys, you know, they're from the ages of 15 to 19 to 20 to 21 like me. And seeing people like this who haven't lived their lives at all going through this kind of stuff, that this happened for so long that it becomes part of their lives, really sets in a way that I know I could never understand that. That I don't think anyone in this room could ever hope to understand that kind of reality. And I think that's a huge part of this that is driven home by Peter Jackson, because he wanted to make sure people understood that.
One of the defining features of the film is the fact that it's told strictly from a British viewpoint. And I was a little surprised at that, because usually when you watch like a World War One documentary or watch a war film, they're going to try and give a balanced approach to show what the different sides, you know, were faced with. But Peter Jackson sort of explained that the differences weren't really all that much. Once you got out onto the front, we're in the fighting, everybody was sort of in the same scenario in a way. So, Cornelia, did you feel like it detracted at all from being a sort of like monolithic view, or do you think that, like, you know, that did you have any problems at all with it being just a simple British point of view? Do you think he offered a really balanced view?
Yeah, I think that it was fine, because the experience of, you know, the British that's going to be the same as the experience of anybody else that was out there on the front lines. I mean, they all lived in the same squalor in the trenches.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things too is how they got the color right. And when you're watching colorized footage, you always think to yourself, oh, well, you know, it's just grass and, you know, and it's just uniforms. But Peter kind of described that it was actually really difficult to get khaki colors for the British uniforms right, mm-hmm. or to get the gray uniforms for the Germans right, because it seems like just plain colors, but within the color khaki is green and brown and yellow. And so in order to have the proper color for this, you think, oh, well, you just do khaki, but it's actually a really difficult and complex color to initiate. And then, of course, the grass. And then what we actually saw was how he went and got about getting the grass right. Explain to our listeners how what he did, the process that he went through in order to get the grass? You want to take it away, Jack?
So essentially what Peter Jackson did is he decided to take a 2 or 3 day vacation. No, he traveled to, you know, France and in parts to England, and mostly, of course, in France, where a lot of the war took place, in Germany, and, you know, just took photos of all these different areas, of all these different regions, all, you know, countries, sub areas. Even took photos of one particular street or one particular sunken area where he actually had a shot in the film, and he found it, and he knew where it was, so he could get that photo, and got the colors in there just right, because it remains virtually unchanged 100 years later. And doing that made a lot of sense, because in large part what he explains is the greens in New Zealand, the greens in America, the greens in England and France, they're all different. I'll tell you from experience, they're different. I've been to France. It is a very different way. It looks entirely different, and it's hard to explain unless you've seen it. But that's kind of the reality. So you really want to get that extra dedication. And Peter Jackson definitely went into it by going out there and getting thousands of shots to recreate the coloration of the foliage and the greenery of that part of the world.
So the color is one thing. Another thing that they had in abundance was audio, was sound. And I think the sound is one of probably the most striking aspects of this documentary, because not only are you getting the sound of artillery being fired, actual artillery that they captured for this documentary, but there was also audio of a spoken word that was recreated by actors who were veterans that voiced some of the soldiers. But there was one particular story that really stood out, and it was the soldier who was reading the pep talk. Camelia, what did you think about that? And can you kind of describe for us what it was Peter Jackson discovered?
Well, when they watched the video, it was hard to tell what he was saying because of the angle.
British officer, yeah.
Right, the British officer. And so they went through all of the archive information, and they ended up finding a sheet of paper that had basically a pep talk for the troops. And they read it through, lined it up, and figured out that it was the exact same thing. And so that's how they ended up being able to voice over that section.
And it was astonishing, because Peter Jackson had revealed that he had actually seen this little bit of footage many times, and no one had known what it was the officer was reading to the troops. And all of a sudden, you know, he finds this note from the War Department that was the pep talk, and he was able to narrow it down and to have narrated this pep talk that this British officer was giving to the soldiers the day before they died. So the audio is very striking. The sounds that you hear, it's not just the visuals and the beautiful colors and cinematic way that he sort of paints things, but it was also what you were hearing in the documentary that made a profound impact. Let's talk about the explosions.
Yes.
Yeah, those are something else.
Yeah, because...
That's what made you jump.
Like I mentioned, it was the most important thing for me.
Yeah, the big booms. Yeah, were there any moments of the explosions that really stood out for you, that really like gave you pause or like made you think?
Frankly, I think any time they lined it up with the footage of actual artillery fire was probably some of the strongest stuff we saw. For those of you who, you know, haven't seen it yet or are listening at home, what essentially happened is the production crew worked with the New Zealand government to record a bunch of artillery fire going off for field training and testing, and put a bunch of, you know, microphones, audio equipment all over a field and had artillery fired into that field and recorded this stuff. And because of the fact that the New Zealand military uses an artillery of similar caliber to that of used in World War I, they got really close to making it sound exactly the same without actually having to recreate and fire old artillery equipment. And it's just impressive. The amount of specifics that went into it, the fact that they made sure that they lined up an artillery fire of conventional means versus, say, shrapnel or frag, you know, that explodes midair and then just rains down, molten iron on people. Or not molten, but like scorching iron. It's just absolutely breathtaking to see that kind of stuff recreated, but also terrifying.
Yeah. Like one of the explosions that was recorded was the attempt to destroy a German trench. They had tried to dynamite a German trench, and then they realized that they dynamited it too far away from the German trench. And it was this giant explosion that created a cavernous opening in the ground. And then, of course, the Germans just fled right into it, and it became a massacre. But the scale of the explosions, I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, several city blocks, you know, in terms of size. I mean, how many men just gone in an instant from explosions that big? You know, the world had never seen war on that scale before. You'd want to say something, Camille?
Well, I was going to say, you know, and there were many who were killed just by the dirt, the ground that was displaced and coming down. I mean, you know, when it showed that, there was just huge walls of ground in the air, and it was massive. It's hard to imagine.
So the documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old, gets a perfect score for me on the documentary film level, because I think what was interesting, and we'll talk about the politics and the history of and philosophy of World War I in just a few minutes, but it wasn't a political film. It wasn't a documentary. It wasn't about the British side of the war. It wasn't about the Germans. It was about, you know, the human side. The human side.
The human spirit.
It was about the men and their stories, and that's illustrated by the fact that they actually had, from the BBC, recorded interviews from veterans of World War I that had told their stories. But what I thought was interesting was that Peter Jackson said what we selected for this film wasn't, you know, just the war stories. It was really just the mundane, the things that they did. All they did was, what did they eat? You know, how did they make their food? You know, at one point we saw a little campfire. The tea was being brewed in a little side wall where they had like little matchsticks that they were using to heat up the tea. And then, of course, nobody could cook, so they made horrible stew. And then they would mete out the stew from like these like giant like coolers that look like, right? And then they, when they drank water, they would drink it out of gas cans.
Well, my favorite is, you know, the fact that their machine guns were water cooled, so they'd take out the boiling water now inside the water cooled gun and make tea out of it. Because of course a Brit has to make tea, but
yeah, they gotta brew up.
I think that Peter Jackson was right when he said, you know, this is a movie made by a non-historian for non-historians. Mm-hmm. He didn't include any historians' intakes. It was entirely those interviews that were the basis of any kind of explanations that were going on. Because like Austin said, it was a story of the mundane. It was the daily lives, and it really wanted to put you in sort of at least a snapshot of the perspective of these people. Because, you know, when they come home, they were a race apart. They were not anymore members of ordinary life, and they could never hope to be.
Camelia, did this documentary show you a side of the war that you had never kind of seen before, would you say?
I think so. And to me, probably the most amazing part is how they can keep smiling and joking through all
there was
of
a lot of laughter.
Horrors.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that just, to me, that really shows the human spirit. I mean, you know, some men went in willingly to this war. Other men were shamed into it with the white feather and...
Whoa,
now
that's the politics of the war. We'll talk about that here in just a moment with, about the white feather. The insufferable, see you next Tuesdays, that was the preparing to be the feminist movement, the women's suffrage movement. They were the ones who were out there encouraging men to go to war. But we'll talk about that in a moment, but stick to the documentary such as it was. Jack, did you see a side of the war that you had never seen before?
I feel like I had a general understanding of the true horror of war because I've gone a lot of, you know, the extra mile to understand that perspective in a more modern sense, but we always knew that war made people into this way. I think what it does, though, and I think this is the strength of the movie and why, frankly, it's one of the greatest movies ever made, already on my list as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that it best illuminates out of any of the media I've ever read or listened to or seen what it's like to have to go through that kind of stuff and the perspective of someone in it to the point where they didn't necessarily have or have not a problem with it. They kind of just lived it. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand about war, and being someone who hasn't been in it, I can't understand that perspective, but I can at least see it from the outside and say, oh, I'll never get this. And I think that's something everyone needs to get about war.
Mm-hmm. And it illustrates the toll that it took in that when the war ended, everybody at home celebrated. But to the men that were there on the front lines, it was just, there was none of that. They were just quiet because there was no energy left to celebrate.
Yeah, and a couple of things that were interesting too is about the fact that the soldiers, when they returned home, it kind of reminded me like what we heard about what happened to Vietnam War soldiers who returned, because they were not welcomed home as liberators and victors. They were brought home and they immediately had no jobs, and even some workplaces refused to hire them because of the fact that they had served in the war and they couldn't assimilate back into society. You could see someone like one particular soldier, for example, who had the shaking arm that they showed a few times, who has clearly had signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, it's sort of a foreshadowing of the same kinds of problems that many of our current service members still face. But, of course, in World War I, we had no understanding of those kinds of diseases. I mean, you know, for all we know, they could have taken that man back and court-martialed him. I mean, everybody else that was walking out was clearly wounded, and all he had was a shaky arm. You can imagine that at the time, you know, basic understanding of medical science, you know, they would have said, well, there's not a scratch on your body, mate. Get back out there and drill Fritz, you know. So it's it just kind of goes to show that, you know, that we are not far removed from the barbarity of the world wars. We are not far removed from the horrors and the evils of the world wars. And the horror and the evil of World War One, I think, takes back step from World War II in many respects. And I think documentaries like this do a good job of giving people an insight into one of the forgotten wars of American history, of world history. So now we focus mostly on the documentary and the technical aspects of the documentary. I'd like to put a pin on it and, you know, close that, and we'll leave a bookmark in, and maybe we can discuss it as for the rest of this discussion. But I'd like to have a little bit of a broader discussion for a few minutes with the three of us about what lessons there are from World War One. So I guess my first question is for you, Jack. What do you think are some of the biggest takeaways of World War One, either politically or philosophically? To you, what is it about World War One that stands out the most that you take away from it, that really attracts you and that you find the most interesting, perhaps?
In a political sense?
Whatever you like.
I suppose that at the end of the day, the people who fought the wars didn't know why they were fighting. I mean, I think that's the case about human history. Any war that's ever been fought was because of a bunch of aristocrats determining how the world should work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in large part, it plays to my individualist heartstrings, I suppose, that I see the people who are fighting and they don't care. They don't necessarily want to fight the war. They don't know why, but they know they have to because of a, you know, a sort of sense of the nation. And more importantly, in the case of the World War, or First World War, you see the rise of globalism. In large part, this is a war caused not by nationalism, as many will say, but as a rare few will say, globalism, because the war started not because there was one side fighting another over a nationalistic fervor, but because of the entangling alliances between nations that drove every single one after another, into this conflict. And that's what made it an escalated conflict, because while there's a lot of danger in both nationalism and globalism, only one can make a minor conflict into a world conflict that, quite frankly, scared half the world into realizing that this kind of danger is coming.
It was the last war of empires, and what's interesting to me is that the sort of naked desire for conquest was just that, naked. It was much more blatant. The reasons why in World War I and to a degree in World War II, the reasons why nations acted was in their own what perceived best interests. So we don't like to say publicly, or unless, you know, you work for Democracy Now or some leftist outfit, that the war in Iraq and Afghanistan are mostly about the oil pipelines. But in World War I, the entire reason for the British going to war with the Turks was for the control of the oil fields in the Middle East. And we look for more lofty reasons for us to engage in wars of conquest in the modern era. But in World War I, the last war of empires, I think there was a desire by the aristocrats of those nations to maintain their holds on powers as they felt it slipping away. I mean, look at Russia as a perfect example. Tsar Nicholas II probably saw in World War I an opportunity for him to make a name for himself, for him to prove himself, coming from a long line of warriors. You know, he was very much shown to be wanting, and the rise of Bolshevism and Menshevism in Russia was a threat, direct threat to his power. I mean, in some ways, World War I was inevitable. And in other ways, I think it was avoidable. Would you say, Camellia, that World War I was inevitable, or do you think that it was avoidable, in your opinion?
I don't know if it was avoidable. I don't think that any of them anticipated just how long that it would go. They were used to, you know, these relatively short-lived, you know, battles where, you know, you fight, you exchange some territory, and then, you know, you go your way, and, you know, it's fun, mm-hmm. You know, battles are fun. But it was no longer that way, and eventually war became profitable.
Yeah, because the war armaments industry grew up in the member states. And one of the things that we as Americans tend to do is we look at things from a U.S.-centric worldview. And the World War I, the United States did not come in until the very, very end. Mm-hmm. We take a lot of credit for winning World War I, but the fact of the matter is that after everybody had beaten themselves into a bloody pulp, the United States suddenly decided to arrive. Woodrow Wilson got reelected on the promise of, hey, he kept us out of the war, until he didn't. But, you know, I've made arguments in the past, and even in presidential debates, for some weird reason, I can't say, that World War I was an unnecessary war. It was a war of choice. It was a war of intervention. And certainly my libertarian bona fides are at stake here having this discussion. But in some ways, it was inevitable because of the decisions that were made by German high command to engage in unrestricted submarine warfare, to basically almost auction off to Mexico land in the United States if Mexico would attack the United States. Really stupid idea. Build the wall. See, if we'd build the wall back then, we wouldn't have to worry about the Mexican invasion.
For those of you who don't know, Austin stared daggers at me for that one. Well, we'll leave that discussion for another day. How about that?
Well, can we all agree that Woodrow Wilson was the worst president in American history?
I think so.
Recent American history. I don't know. There's a lot of bad ones out there.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's in the top five, top six, tops.
Definitely. In my opinion, Woodrow Wilson's the worst president, not just because of his war policy, but because of his domestic policy as well. You know, World War One. I honestly think that in some ways, World War One has even more lessons for people today who are interested in history and how we got here. The evolution of tanks and what tanks meant for the battlefield, and here we still have tanks today. Tanks are still a very important part of military strategy. Trench warfare that, you know, was just starting to be devised around the time of the American Civil War was put into full effect. And to a degree was still used, even in World War II, there were still quite a few trenches that were being used. And even today, you know, soldiers are still taught to dig in and given entrenching tools. But, well, go ahead, Jack.
I think that in the short term, World War II is the most important war of recent history to follow it. And it's probably going to be for the next 100 or 200 years following it. But I think when people look back on history, say, hundreds of years in the future, God forbid that happen, or God not forbid, I think that people will find that World War One was a pivotal moment in deciding how the warfare of the era was decided. It was the biggest political change, even considering World War Two. And it spelled sort of the beginning of an era of existence in military, in global socioeconomic conflicts, at least to follow, and for the foreseeable future. All war, even now, is a reflection of World War One. Sure, we don't necessarily, there weren't nukes or helicopters back then, but in large part, a lot of the modern conventions of war started during that one.
Yeah, there were so many techniques that were devised in World War One that are still being used today. types of machine guns, for example, still a staple of modern war, and had not, you know, really been used until that point. I feel like there's something romantic about war. And you see that in this documentary, because they're all so happy to go off to war until they finally get to the front. Mm-hmm. And once they finally get to the front, all of their romantic dreams, their, you know, the dreams that they had about glory. I mean, there was even one story of a soldier who was saying he was terrified that the war would be over before he got to the front. And then all of a sudden his opinions change. I think there was an old quote by Robert E. Lee, and I'm sure my podcasters will double check when I'm wrong, that he said something to the effect of, it is good that war is hell, lest we grow too fond of it. Because there sort of is a desire on behalf of people. There is like a desire for war and conquest. I mean, there's just, for some insane reason, there are, you know, there is some instinct, maybe within all of us, to glorify war and to look at war as some romantic concept. But I think documentaries like this put it in a pretty good perspective. Because while, you know, our military propaganda recruitment outlets are always going to give us the best case scenario and talk about GI bills and everything, and we certainly have a different view towards the soldiers than we used to have, it's not a glorious job. It's not the kind of job. I mean, to a degree, you're cannon fodder. For many of those people, like the soldiers who were in that sunken road, you know, and then 30 minutes later, they were all dead. I mean, what was the point of that sacrifice?
Didn't accomplish anything.
Right, it accomplished nothing. They put themselves up against one another, and really, at the end of it, what was really decided after the end of World War One?
And that was a lot of the trench warfare.
Mm-hmm.
There was no ground gained.
Well, and it's pointless. It shows, again, the issue which I've always personally had with war, which is, it's especially early war, but even now it still happens, aristocrats deciding how the peasants will die.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who were responsible for the war, their punishments were, compared to the people who died, very much muted, very much weak, very much limp, as I'll use that term. And frankly, it illuminates a good part of history, the nature of being a frontline peon, mm-hmm. as it would be, according to them. And that's one thing I like about modern films, especially in modern war films. They really show that desperation, that heartache, that pain that soldiers go through. And I think that that's one great thing that our films have done for us in recent history. Because you have even, you know, for example, last year, Dunkirk. I think Dunkirk is a great film and the best film of 2017, going off on a quick side tangent, because it shows the desperation of war, of conflict, of battle, the hell that people go through. going through that in even so much of a short time as a couple days. And span that over the course of several years, and you truly get just an understanding from that snapshot of what hell on earth looks like.
Camelia, one of the minute political details that was mentioned in the documentary was the White Feather Movement. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of the White Feather Movement before today?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the White Feather Movement was?
Well, essentially, it was the way for patriotic young ladies to help with the war effort. And what they would do is they would walk the streets, and if they saw any man who looked like he was eligible to have joined the military, they would approach him and, you know, ask him why, you know, he hadn't gone to war, and they would say things that would shame him, and they would, you know, call him names and, you know, say very negative things about him. And then they would stick a white feather in his lapel or whatever and basically shame him into going into enlisting.
Yeah. And this was really when, like, the feminist movement was starting to come together, because one of the other aspects of the film that we started to see was that while men were going to the front, wartime production at home still needed to be maintained. And mm-hmm. so many of the women who, although they did not have the right to vote in the UK at that point, many of the women were in the factories manufacturing many of the war munitions and bullets and things that were needed to go to the front. But politically, the women who were involved in the war effort at home, to a large extent, were their job was to shame men into joining the military. And it's incredible to me that people are so willing to sacrifice other people's lives when their own lives really aren't much at risk. Mm-hmm. There's something, I don't know, I can't say unchivalrous, because there's no set of code of behavior that's a set of obligatory responsibilities from females to males as there is the other way around. Like, there's sort of an obligation that men have towards women that, you know, war sort of, it manifests, the set of obligations that men have towards women, I think war in some ways manifests it in the ugliest possible way.
Well, and that's what they were doing, is they were basically telling them that they weren't chivalrous, that they weren't doing their manly duty.
Right.
You know, by going to war and defending the women.
Right. When we visited the World War One Museum, one of the posters that we saw was a poster of a woman with her baby sinking to the bottom of the ocean saying, "Enlist now." I mean, there's nothing that tugs on the heartstrings of men more than to see innocent women and children suffering. But I guess what changed perhaps between World War One and World War Two is the concept that there really are no civilians in war. Mm-hmm. Because once the understanding was made that if you are part of a munitions facility, if you are part of a facility that manufactures metal for tanks, you become a legitimate military target. So all of a sudden, it's no longer a chivalrous war. It's not like the Napoleonic Wars, where, you know, the British and the Austrians are going, you know, going to war, and the French and all of these empires are going to war. Now all of a sudden, it's an entire nation is being mobilized to go to war. That's one of probably the biggest changes that happened with World War One, is that all of a sudden it's complete and total mobilization of our economy and of the people who wouldn't normally be involved in a conflict in any way, shape, or form. It's sad, it's devastating, and it's shaped the world that we live in today. Jack, did you want to...
Fun fact, actually, yeah. And I think this is a good history bit, and people will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. Is that during the White Feather Movement, they would actually start going after, whether intentionally or not, I think it was unintentionally, medical leave soldiers, those who were at home, or those who were even on a regular leave, because some of that would happen, although it was a lot more rare in World War One. Mm-hmm. Those people who were home on that medical situation, or had a viable reason, or, you know, looked young but were old, oftentimes they would be, you know, awarded a medal that actually, you know, showed they were home for a good reason, that these people are here reasonably speaking, and it was to prevent the sort of negative effects of the White Feather Movement, because those people didn't care. When it's not your life on the line, you don't take the time to discriminate those who you can target. And I think that the behavior ultimately can be called uncouth, and I think that is probably the best word to use, because there's no good word to describe it.
Well, I think probably one of the concepts that we don't discuss is the concept of just how disposable these men's lives were to not just their own governments, but to their fellow countrymen. Because the when they returned home, the way that they were treated by the civilians, it's not like today. The kind of patriotic fervor that we have towards our soldiers just didn't exist at the time. And sometimes I think in our modern age, we go a little too far even with the patriotism, or I won't say patriotism, but I'll say perhaps with nationalism. And it's amazing to me that so many men died. When my father and I, whenever we go to Washington, D.C., he was a Vietnam-era veteran. We go to the wall, and he sees his buddies' names on the wall, and he always cries. And my father is a conservative, okay? He's not some leftist, hippie, liberal, anti-war type. But he never doesn't say, that was pointless. He always says, well, this was pointless. I mean, what was the point of all of this conflict and fighting? What did it really gain? All it did was give us another grander conflict of even more of greater scale and a higher death count and more efficient ways to kill each other. All of the weapons that were developed in World War I were developed as a way, they were argued that they would save lives. The argument was that we were supposed to reduce the number of people who would die, at least on our side. But all it did was expand with using gas warfare and then eventually World War II, to nukes and cluster bombs and fire bombs. That all we've done is found new ways to kill even more people. We haven't reduced the conflict in many ways at all. But then again, of course, if you look at the number of people who die in armed conflicts, it's much less today than it was, back in the 20th century. So there's a lot of paradoxes too with some of the philosophical problems and the historical issues that you look at with World War I. So I'm going to give you guys both now your chance to give your final thoughts on the documentary and on World War I, and then I'll wrap it up. Camellia, would you like to start for us and tell us just your final thoughts on the documentary, your key takeaways, anything that you'd like to say or add as we put a button on the end of the war?
I think that it was just done very well in terms of making it real to imagine that you could be there. I mean, the sound was big. Mm-hmm. I mean, when the explosions happened, you jumped because you got a little taste.
Rumbled in your heart.
Right. Yeah. You got a little taste of what they, heard day in, day out, and felt the ground shake around them. And, silence was odd for them. Mm-hmm. And so I think that brought that home very well. And the leaps that were made in technology during World War I and how long it went on and those issues that they grappled with really set the stage. And it just, the sheer number of lives that were lost. I mean, for the British alone, it was a million, and they were small. So it's a lot.
Yeah. Jack, final thoughts.
I think that this is one of the, as I've said, best movies ever made. Peter Jackson came at this project with a sort of humility that I think can't be truly expressed in words, but can only be expressed in the actions of his work. Every single part of it comes together to really make you understand what this war is about, what this war is like, and brings you through the journey of it in a very short time. But you feel every single second just drag on in a way that lets you understand, at least even if a moment, what this kind of stuff is like and what it means to go through it. And I think that's the strength of this movie.
The thing about movies is that it's all about sights and sounds. Film is about sights and sounds. But we have these other senses that aren't typically used or thought about during films. And one of the senses that was activated for me, at least, was the smell. Because two things really stood out for me is the amount of mud that was everywhere. The mud and the bodies and the things that they discussed were the dead horses. And they talked about, if you've ever smelled a dead mouse, you think about the smell of a dead mouse and then magnify it times 1,000. And that's what it smelled like to have all of the dead horses. So the blood and the mud and the death, I think that the seeing and hearing it in such a realistic way, I could almost smell the battlefield. I could almost smell the powder and the the gun smoke that was crossing the fields. And when we saw the gas creeping across the fields. It looked filthy, just disgusting. It was a stinking, disgusting cloud of death sweeping over. You could almost smell it. And so I think that when I, and then of course, one comedic part, again, spoiler alert, you could, of how did they take a shit? You know, the soldiers sat on a giant log or a stick.
What happens when you get dysentery? What happens,
right, right. And so there would be four of them, four British soldiers sitting on there with their asses and their balls hanging out, and they're taking a shit of the end. And then, of course, there was one moment when the board cracked and they all fell into the shit and they had to bring them out all slimy. I could almost smell it the moment that that occurred. So you know that a film is powerful when not only do you see beautiful things that delight your visual senses, not only do you hear and feel sounds that delight your audio senses, but a good film you can almost smell. And Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old is one of those films that is so good that you can almost smell it, that you're almost there. I'm Austin Peterson here in Kansas City. You're listening to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm here with my good friends, Jack Stocker and Camelia Plosser. I would like to say that personally, I think this is a great documentary. It's definitely one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I would like to highly recommend. Jack, when did they say that the other screening was going to be here in the United States? There's a chance for our listeners to see it if they would like.
December 27th.
December 27th, don't do what some people probably did and show up to the theater and think you're going to get a ticket, because it's a very limited screening and the interest is pretty high. The First World War ended 100 years ago this year, this November, and I hope that this podcast has inspired you to learn a little bit more about World War I. And if you'd like to participate with Jack and Camelia and I in some of our historical, philosophical, and just fun hangout sessions, you can always find us usually on weeknights and definitely weekends on our Twitch account, twitch.com/AP for Liberty. It has been a delight to have this experience with my good friends. I'd like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Podbean. If you'd like to support podcasts, more of the Freedom Report podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/AP for Liberty. Basically, if you type in AP for Liberty on any social network, you're going to find me there. Thanks so much, and have a Happy Christmas and a Merry New Year. Right?
Yeet.
The music, the artists, the culture. This is who we are, and this is who we be. Check out Who We Be Talks, a Spotify original podcast.
Yo, it's DJ Semsex and Pirates. Let's get straight into it.
Get the latest on UK street culture, from the hottest artists through to the newest trends and the issues you care about. Who We Be Talks. New episodes every Thursday, exclusively on Spotify.
Santa's sleigh. Can I get a phone?
Finally, a question you can say yes to. At Tesco Mobile, get the iMOS 2 with Monkey, the smartphone tech built to keep kids safe and happy and give parents peace of mind. All for only £99 when you buy a £10 top-up. However you do Christmas, everyone's welcome at Tesco Mobile.
Phone subject to availability and locked to Tesco Mobile Network. Minutes, text and data to standard UK landline and mobiles and between home from home destinations. Fair use policy applies. See tescomobile.com/terms.